All rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning, everyone. Counsel, are you prepared to argue?
Yeah, I'm telling you, yes. Good morning.
And Mr. Torque, am I understanding you're reserving 5 minutes?
Yes, please.
Okay. Major Legato, are you ready?
Yes, Tom.
May we proceed?
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Soroka, I represent appellant. It appears we have a lot to discuss this morning. I think the briefing is mostly adequate, but there are a few issues that I would like to specifically raise that I don't think is adequately discussed. And specifically what I'd like to discuss this morning are the validity of the NDA orders and whether they're sufficient to constitute Article 2A jurisdiction, as well as obviously the issue of whether there is jurisdiction under Phillips, whether Morse survives Phillips, as well as the government's motion for reconsideration.
Just to be clear up front, you're only challenging subject matter jurisdiction on appeal, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. With regard to the what I'm just going to call the NPA orders, although some of them are also in active duty training, but I think for our purposes they're the same. One of the issues that I think is critical is there was no evidence presented at trial that these were proper or lawful orders. And actually, the evidence that the government seeks to submit does not assist us in making that determination. Colonel Purvis, Mr. Purvis, his testimony at trial was quite vague, said effectively, I do recall that we requested additional manpower days for Colonel Reed. He was not presented with any of the orders that are being presented for this court's review and asked, did you authorize these days? His signature does not appear on the documents that have been offered for submission, and there was no testimony anywhere during the trial to the effect that the following orders were authorized by the supervising officer of the health facilities office. So what we do know is that at least three of those orders were listed as fraudulent orders. And what we do know is that it appears from the testimony of trial that Colonel Marino would enter information into Arrows to request additional days. There was no testimony from anyone at the reserve office on the other end of Arrows saying we got confirmation that these were valid orders. All we know is that the information was entered into Arrows and a document was produced.
Tell me if I understand the facts as presented at trial correctly. In motions practice, the government introduced some number of NPA requests to give him these 120-day periods. Carl Purvis was aware of that, and generally the agreement he had with the appellant was that the appellant would perform 120 days of NPA duty, but not necessarily the times that were listed on the documentation. The appellant then was charged with sometimes within the 120-day period, sometimes without, outside the 120-day period, forging signatures, larceny from the government, and so forth. And it seemed clear from the record of trial that the appellant was taking advantage of the lack of oversight in the office to basically go on trips, sometimes which were authorized, sometimes which may not have been, and there was not a lot of tracking by the government as to when he was going on trips and when he wasn't. A, is that an accurate statement of the facts? And B, if so, why should the appellant be able to benefit from the jurisdictional hole his own actions essentially created?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I'm not sure that I would completely agree with the characterization, but certainly the facts were that the government was not tracking his days. and that there was an informal agreement that the MPA days could be used on an as-needed basis, although, as it turns out, that was not a proper use of those days. They were to be used consecutively. But nonetheless, that was the sort of informal nature of the agreement that was there. The government's theory of trial was exactly as you have articulated, that the appellant was taking advantage of the situation and effectively was not actually doing any work at all, but was just traveling around and doing whatever he saw fit and collecting pay as a result. You cited in the briefs number of occasions in which trial counsel explicitly articulated that both to the military judge and to the members, stating that even if there was actual work being done, because it was being done under false pretenses, it was theft. And therefore, they didn't actually have to go through and articulate whether there was proper work being done, because under the government's theory, as soon as there was a fraudulent signature or fraudulent order, that was it. It didn't matter. To go to the second part of your question, the government has now had four opportunities to prove jurisdiction in this matter, and at all times we maintain that Colonel Rita remains subject to the Federal Criminal Code. The government is the one that decided how to proceed in terms of prosecution. And as early as the Article 32 hearing, the investigating officer, Major Thomas, explicitly raised the issue in her report, and in fact, frankly, gave a roadmap to the government to say, this is what you need to do in order to line up the dates, in order to line up the evidence, so that it can be clear that jurisdiction attaches here. I would note, Major Thomas is a reservist, and her day job is an assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California, which would be the office that would have jurisdiction over these offenses in federal criminal court. So there was ample opportunity for the government to decide, we're troubled with jurisdiction here, and but we want to secure a conviction, so we're going to go through the civilian courts. There would be no question that there would be civilian jurisdiction in the federal courts. So,
so I understand that there may have been another option, another sovereign to prosecute, or another route by which he could have been prosecuted. From a policy perspective, though, as we're dealing with the issue before us here as to whether there was jurisdiction under the UCMJ, why should the appellant be allowed to benefit from the ambiguity that his own actions as charged at trial created?
Well, I think there's a number of issues that the court has to be concerned with. I mean, one of the obvious ones is that the appellant is a reservist, and issues of jurisdiction are more complicated in that regard than they are with an active duty member. If you were an active duty member, we wouldn't be having these conversations. Jurisdiction would be clear. I think in terms of weighing some of the policy considerations, among them are the fact that reservists are have a different role, and that if they are not called to active duty and if they are not lawfully called to active duty, then they're not supposed to be considered subject to UCMJ jurisdiction. And balancing that along with the policy fact that this is not a situation where offenses would go unpunished otherwise. If these were offenses for which there was no other sovereign that could prosecute, then I think that the court's consideration there would have a greater weight. But all along, this issue has been raised, and I think the burden is on the government to make a call as far as that goes. And if they make the wrong call, I would say it's analogous in some ways to other doctrines that we have in the criminal courts, such as suppression as a remedy for government misconduct. Now, that undoubtedly often results in offenses going unpunished, but we tolerate that in order to maintain the Constitution, in order to maintain the Fourth Amendment. And I think similarly here, because there's a very strong consideration that reservists not be subject to UCMJ jurisdiction if they're not lawfully called to service, and I think even if you were to consider that to be a windfall for the appellant, that is a reasonable price to pay for upholding otherwise regular standards. And
is your argument that there was never any NPA days or ITD days that were legitimately authorized, not done by the actions of the appellant?
I'm sorry, do I think there were? Was that my question?
I'm just trying to understand what you're telling us what the facts are.
Yeah.
You know, were there any days in which the appellant was legitimately on NPA, what you're calling, defining as NPA orders?
Well, I'll tell you, to be frank, I went back through the record a couple of times to try and answer that very question, because I had a feeling the court was going to want to know, and I wanted to know for myself. And the best I can come up with is the testimony of Colonel Purvis saying, I recall that signing a document relating to a 120-day request. He didn't say when it was. He didn't say which document it was. That's all he said, and there was no follow-up on that, and he was not presented with any documents related to that. So all I can say is, by preponderance of the evidence on the record before you, the answer is no.
Okay. Now, with respect to the days, the NPA days that he performed pursuant to his own actions, apparently those were fraudulent actions, then how is that any different than a fraudulent enlistment, in which we do have jurisdiction over?
Sure. So, and this, of course, goes to the legislative history that the government sought to admit. I think there's a big distinction to be made between fraudulent enlistment and whether or not a reservist is actively and lawfully called to active duty. First of all, once a member is properly enlisted, whether it's through the doctrine of construction enlistment or through a valid enlistment process, jurisdiction attaches then and forever. That is to say, until they are no longer in the service. In the case of the reservist, they are only subject to jurisdiction at the time that they're lawfully called into training or to active duty. So if we were to make the analogy there, it doesn't hold for purposes of reservists, because they come in and out of service as they're supposed to do. And the question would be, how would you then construct a date at which you would say, okay, well, we don't think that constructive active duty, which would be what we'd be calling it essentially, any longer applies. I think that becomes quite problematic. I think also when you look at the legislative history that the government has cited, it's very clear there's no question that this has to do with fraudulent enlistment of active duty members. And to the extent that this is at all determinative, I don't think there was any thought indicated that this would be applied to reservists in this manner. And it creates a lot of problems, I think, because you're not able to determine when the member was released from duty, if they're releasing themselves from duty, does that count? So I guess I think the analogy doesn't hold between fraudulent enlistment and putting yourself on orders.
More broadly than the legislative history behind Article 2C, in fraudulent enlistment, the jurisdictional hook is the receipt of pay and allowances. And the charge misconduct here was all about receipt of pay and allowances. You've made the comment a couple of times now that there needs to be a bright line for reservists between times when they're on orders or in status and not in status, but we're not starting with a clean slate here. In Phillips, the court opened the door, maybe a crack, maybe a mile, to say that it's not so simple as looking at when a member is actually in a Article 2A status. So considering that these offenses involved receipt of pay and allowances, why does or doesn't Phillips apply to this scenario?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's an important point, because what Phillips tells us is, fraudulent enlistment doctrine notwithstanding, the four-part test still has to be applied. Okay, so the member still has to be, well, actually, it's really a five-part. They have to be serving with the armed forces, and then there's the four-part test of 2C. And I think in this case, you know, the two issues, we're obviously not contesting whether or not the appellant received pay. That seems quite out, you know, quite clear. But the real question is, did the appellant perform military duty, and did he voluntarily submit to military authority? And our position is absolutely not. When you look at Phillips, I think...
So you're saying when he creates a document that allows him to perform military duties, that that's not a voluntary act on his part?
Well, it's a voluntary act. I wouldn't say it's a voluntary submission to military authority. On the contrary, as we cited in the briefs, you know, the government's theory was this was the appellant's way of being able to go around and do whatever he wanted on the government's dime. If that's the case, that couldn't possibly be a voluntary submission to military authority because he's not abiding by any of the regulations. He's not abiding by any lawful orders. That wouldn't be a voluntary submission.
Wasn't he performing military duty?
No, I don't think he was. I think by analogy, if a pilot puts himself on false orders and takes an F-16 out for a spin, I don't think he's performing military duty at that point. It's unauthorized activity, even though the act of piloting a fighter jet is obviously what you would consider to be in the nature of military duty. He doesn't have a duty to perform it. He's not obligated to do so, and he's not doing so pursuant to lawful orders. So the same thing here. The government's whole theory of trial was this was all a joyride. This was all an attempt to go wherever he wanted to, wanted to go and collect pay for it. He was not under any duty to do so, and he, according to the government, wasn't performing any military duty. He wasn't doing what he was supposed to be. In Phillips, the court, quite clearly said that Colonel Phillips performed her duty, which was to travel to base, and that was what she had been ordered to do in order to, report for her annual tour. And because she was ordered to travel to base, she performed that duty and she committed the offense while doing that duty. We now have met the four-part test, and that's at that's at page 220 of the Phillips opinion. And I think that's extremely important. Here we don't have the evidence that the appellant was performing military duty, and this is I'm glad we're getting to this because critical point that I really wanted to make this morning is, we still don't have evidence of when the offenses were committed. The government's theory, by implication, although they have not stated so explicitly, is that whatever dates are on the fraudulent travel vouchers are the dates the offenses were committed. There's nothing to support that theory, however. If the signatures are false, how do we know that the dates that were also put there by the same hand are also not false? There's never been a definitive statement by the government of how we know when these offenses occurred. They're assuming that the date they were signed is when they occurred. But of course, if you sign a false travel voucher and it sits in your drawer, you haven't committed the forgery yet because it doesn't inure to the detriment of another until you actually submit it.
I understand your point on the fourth Article 2C factor, but of course the threshold question, the question that Phillips really focused on was, is the person serving with the armed forces? Now, a case such as this, where the appellant was a member of a reserve component, used his position as a member of the reserve component to get military pay and allowances, which under the charged offenses he was not entitled to, used military documents to forge the signatures of military superiors and others in the office, using his knowledge of reserve procedures, why does Phillips not extend to this scenario to say that the appellant was not serving with the armed forces?
Well, because he didn't do it. Well, first of all, he didn't do it when he was on lawful orders, and he didn't voluntarily submit to military authority, and he didn't perform any military duty. In Phillips, the appellant performed the offense while on duty, on base, and was clearly in the midst of a lawful order, a travel day, that she was in performing her duty. So Phillips goes directly to all those. Here, the scenario that you just described, you imagine that any reservist with knowledge of the system could sit at home and do nothing and submit fraudulent paperwork and collect pay. I would submit to the court that that is an ordinary mail fraud, wire fraud type of case, defrauding the government. It's no different than submitting false claims to Medicare or any other number of ways in which people try and obtain benefits from the government, you know, unlawfully. The fact that it happens to be the military doesn't make jurisdiction attached to the military unless you have all of the factors, you know, in the four-part test. So the fact that the appellant knew the system, knew how to use it, and was doing so in and of itself is not enough. Otherwise, the statement in Phillips that simply being a member of the reserve is not enough would have no meaning. And that's really key, is to see how is the member acting as an active member of the armed forces. In other words, we want them to be the equivalent of being on active duty. That's this sort of constructive active duty doctrine that we're looking at here under Article 2C. Is in what way are they the functional equivalent of an active duty member, somebody who's performing duty pursuant to lawful orders, somebody who's performing military duty, and so forth. And that's not what we have, you know, in this case. I'm noting that the time is short, so I want to make sure I also make just a couple points regarding the government's motion for reconsideration relating to the submission of the additional documents. with regard to the MPA orders, and I did raise this briefly before, I don't think that these documents do what they want them to do. These are not, these are just records of what's in Arrows. But there's no evidence of how those got into Arrows other than the evidence at trial that the practice would be that the appellant would enter data into Arrows. So it's another example of him putting himself on orders.
So what determines when he's in status and not in status, if not for the official records that the government keeps?
Well, again, if these are fraudulent documents, if he has put himself on orders, the fact that the government has kept these records, that, you know, is irrelevant. The travel vouchers are in the government's possession too, but those are all fraudulent as far as the government's concerned. So that part itself, I think, doesn't matter. What's significant is that there's no evidence that these were processed by, you know, and authorized by a supervisor. So they don't tell us that they're lawful orders.
So under your rationale, then, the government has not put forward evidence that he's in status during any of the charged time period, because the government has to do what? Call a witness to prove that the orders are somehow valid?
Yes. Absolutely. And they had three opportunities to do that at trial, at the Article 32, at the initial assignment of errors, and you know, they haven't done that. I mean, this frankly, Your Honor, this is why the appellate court is not to sit as a fact finder in the first instance, because there's too many unknowns. And similarly, with the pay records, if you look at the affidavit of the person authenticating them, they're not a military employee. They are not the custodian of records. They are simply someone who says that they have access to these records and that they did a search and this is what came up. There's no affidavit stating that they know how to use the military pay record system, or LRV. So, I mean, this is why we don't want these kinds of documents to be coming in at this late state in the game. And I'd also just point out that submitting all this kind of documentation well after trial, you know, I think raises important due process concerns for the accused, who obviously at trial you're in a position to test the veracity of the evidence, you're in a position to cross-examine the witnesses, and all of that is, you know, over and done with at this point. So those are some of the concerns we have about the admission of those documents. And I'd reserve the balance unless the court has other questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Major Realigano, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the government in this matter. A Appellant's fraudulent criminal scheme perpetrated against the Air Force should not be the vehicle which allows him to escape jurisdiction. He abused his power of trust, his position of trust, for 3 years as a senior reserve officer in his unit, depleting their travel fund until it was overdrawn. Just as those who fraudulently enlist are not allowed to escape court-martial jurisdiction, Appellant 2 is subject to it. Now first, to discuss the recon motion, this court asked to what extent were Appellant's actions, did they occur while he was on orders? And it's this question that the government answered with the his pay records and the orders from the Aero system. And we know that facts outside the record can be considered by this court with regarding jurisdiction by this court's own precedent, U.S. v. McCarthy, 24 MJ 841. It also talks about, in that case, the routine practice that is here, routinely done here, is accepting declarations from defense counsel. That, too, is another exception to and the Court of Criminal Appeals is allowed to hear.
But those typically involve issues like ineffective assistance of counsel, issues that normally in the course of business arise after trial. In this case, the Article 32 investigating officer clearly put the government on notice of what it needed to do to demonstrate jurisdiction. The government chose not to do that at trial, and now the government is trying to build the record that should have been built at trial. From a policy standpoint, this is much different than an issue that arises after trial. Why should we allow those documents in now?
At trial, the trial counsel used Article 2C to show jurisdiction over all instances of misconduct. And that was accepted by the military judge by preponderance of the evidence to show jurisdiction. That's at Appellate Exhibit 10 and Appellate Exhibit 38.
The trial counsel made a tactical decision that they didn't want to go through the effort of introducing every piece of paper and lining it up against the charge offenses, taking the risk that the military judge would accept this theory under Morse that actual being in status didn't matter. Why isn't the government bound by that theory now on appeal?
Well, especially in counsel, in light of the fact that the AFI requires the government to submit information showing jurisdiction in these sorts of cases.
Well, the trial counsel made a tactical decision and it was successful at the trial level. It was this court and its fact-finding capability that asked for orders under Article 2A. And it's within this court's power to do so, and the government directly responded to that request.
And just to be clear, I believe our order asked, to what extent did the appellant's actions occur while in status? We didn't necessarily mean that we were authorizing the government to go outside the record to answer that question.
Okay. The evidence was out there, and the government went to find it to completely and directly answer the court's question. This court's allowed to hear evidence about jurisdiction. Even our Superior Court has validated this in U.S. v. Roberts. This court is also at the appellate level in U.S. v. Heimer asked the government to show cause as to why the court had jurisdiction in another case. And the court complied, and there was no issues with it. So we're in the same boat here. So the appellant can raise an issue of jurisdiction under RCM 905E at any time. And in the interest of justice, the government should receive the same consideration.
And under United States v. Oliver, when the appellant does that on appeal for the first time, the government gets that opportunity. What case involving jurisdiction stands for the proposition that when the issue was litigated at trial, the government can bring in new evidence on the same issue that was litigated at trial?
I could not find any case law that stood for that exact proposition, but I note that U.S. v. Oliver does not preclude it, and Article 66C gives this court broad power, which it uses frequently. So if I may move on to the first question that the court asked about, records proving that the appellant was on active duty orders.
Counsel, before you get started, I think it would be helpful, at least for this judge, is if you could go to the calendar chart that you submitted, and if we could at least understand what all these different colors represent.
Okay, so I'm with you.
So, for example, December of 05, there's an entire month of green, along with January and February of 06, and half of March of 06 as well. So apparently it started in November. It looks like that's a 120-day MPA.
Yes.
Now, is that, is there a order that reflects that? You say here on orders, AD or IDT and receiving pay. So the active duty order that does that, is that one that was fraudulently created by the appellant, or is there a separate document that's not fraudulently created?
There is a separate document, and that is on the government's supplemental brief, page 4. It's order number D03934, and that's kind of the corresponding orders versus the calendar.
Okay. Now, what does yellow represent? Like, for example, in 2007, there's a period starting 1 October that goes all the way through January of 08. Looks like another 120-day period, but you say that that's received pay, base pay, and BAH, but you do not say that reflects him being on orders.
Yes, that's what the records reflected, that there were times that he was receiving base pay and BAH that didn't completely overlap with his MPA orders.
So what was submitted to generate the pay?
I don't have that information. I mean, I imagine something had to be submitted, or else, in general, I think it's fair to say that reservists just don't get paid without some sort of documentation causing that to happen.
And then purple, I believe it's purple.
Yes.
These are days then which a forgery was committed, i.e. maybe it was a 1610 or even a travel voucher, 1351, but he was not on any type of status that the records reflect.
Correct, not by
fraudulently the... fraudulently created or otherwise.
By the documents. Yes.
By the documents.
Okay. But that's where Article 2C would come in and cover all those instances. So this was just laying out the dates of when everything was created and when he was receiving pay. Because if you look at the four factors, and different factors mean different things. And so I was just, the government was just putting it all together so you could see when things were happening.
Okay, let's for example, just to kind of tee this up, if a reservist goes on a legitimate authorized TDY for which they run orders, everything was fine, and then the TDY is over, the reservist comes back home, is now not in a pay status, okay, not on an IDT, not in any type of status, is really civilian reservist, okay? And then at that particular day, submits the travel voucher, and in that travel voucher is a fraudulent travel voucher for whatever reason. Would we have jurisdiction over that reservist for that particular crime on that day?
Yes, Your Honor.
Under
U.S. v. Phillips, this court stated that travel is a normal part of military duty, and in discharge of that duty, it was incumbent upon the appellant to adhere to military standards and the UCMJ. Now, that was a different scenario, but when you look at Morse, that Morse stands for the proposition that filling out paperwork, filing paperwork, that's all a part of your travel, your military duty. And so when we put those together, we look at the common sense standard. That's what this court looked at, is common sense, real-world approach to Article 2C, consistent with congressional intent to extend jurisdiction over reservists to the same matter, to the same account as active duty. So when you put that in context and you look at the appellant time after time submitting as Lieutenant Colonel Morita or Major Morita at the time, submitting these documents to try to get orders or amendments, then going on travel, and then coming back and submitting the voucher, which he had to do once federal funds are obligated, which he ensured by his going through the chain, then he had to file a voucher. He did so as Lieutenant Colonel Rita. He wouldn't have access to arrows unless he was doing so in his reserve capacity.
So what language would the government have us employ to find jurisdiction over a reservist in this scenario? Is it any time the misconduct is related to their reserve duties, inherently related to their reserve duties? Does it have to involve pay and allowances? When is that Article 2C test met for a reservist who's not on orders or not in status?
I think the language that Phillips, that this court used in Phillips, is instructive in that. When you're looking at common sense and real world, what needs to happen to get on orders? What needs to happen to get paid? And when doing so, when completing those actions, you're doing so in your military status.
I recognize we had our own opinion in Phillips, but CAF came out, obviously, with its opinion, which doesn't seem to go quite that far, and in fact lists so many facts that it might be limited to its facts on somebody who's traveling on legitimate orders, gets to her place of duty, commits a crime just before, and gets paid for that day but the misconduct occurred. So is there anything in that opinion or otherwise that you think, or would we just be stretching Phillips to apply to a brand new scenario and we're not going to find any case law to help us do that? We're just going to have to do it.
I think Phillips doesn't limit this court's decision in Phillips. It affirmed the decision, and it lists the same factors that this court looked to in Phillips to find that the appellant in that case was under orders under 2C. And in fact, they didn't even look at 2A. They went straight to 2C. So I think using 2C, and their approach was it was very practical. Where was she? What was she doing? Why was she there?
And right now, I have no idea where Lieutenant Colonel Morita was or what he was doing on what days that these things were filed.
Well, in his
case, I know when he dated, and I know when he might have gotten paid according to pay records, but I don't know what he was doing.
That brings up a good point, ma'am. It is irrelevant what date he actually fraudulently signed those documents, because what's important is that when he was doing so as Lieutenant Colonel Morita. So it doesn't matter if it was the 12th of July or the 11th of July in our theory for jurisdiction, because he was doing so in his continuing scheme of misconduct, the scheme that began when he got orders or amended orders so that he could do a side trip to D.C., and it continued throughout that process. And when it went through that process, it was going through the appropriate channels. It was getting federal funds obligated. It was getting... he was getting paid.
But the language of Phillips then, I guess you would say, that talks about her receiving pay and points and travel money on the date she did the misconduct is to be ignored. I mean, we're going to find against the government if we have to go through and check off these factors for that.
Well, I assume that she was paid for that day, but she, of course, got paid later when she submitted everything.
Right, but she ate the brownies on that day.
Her
crime was complete on the night she
was
orders.
Yes, her crime was such a crime that it was a succinct one-time thing. The crime here was this continuing scheme of misconduct. And so I think it's differentiated from there. And so it's not going against Phillips. It's saying that when you have a case where there's a continuing scheme of misconduct, if you're using your status as an Air Force Reserve officer to commit that crime, you are in court-martial jurisdiction.
Is that what the government sees as the critical element here, that it's a continuing course of conduct that skirts both periods when the appellant arguably was in status and was not in status? For example, let me give you a hypothetical to sort of distinguish it. Let's say a reservist hasn't been in status for 2 months, doesn't plan to be in status for another 2 months, logs on to his or her email from home, sends an email to his or her supervisor, and in there is a false official statement regarding some aspect of their reserve duties. Now, that's not a continuing course of conduct. Would you find jurisdiction in a case like the appellant's, but maybe not in the case that I outlined there?
I would find jurisdiction in both because both were in their status. It's just that in each case, you look at the facts and circumstances of that case. And so in our case, it's part of the facts and the circumstances. That's a continuing scheme of misconduct.
So it's the government's position. I'm just trying to be clear here. The government's position is that any time a reservist does anything related to their reserve duties, that UCMJ's jurisdiction attaches?
If the, in order to meet the 2C test, one of the elements is you have to receive pay. So these crimes were all in an effort to receive some sort of monetary amount from the Air Force. So in a circumstance such as that, I guess if he wasn't receiving some sort of pay at that time, it would be, unless he was receiving retirement points for whatever he was doing, that's another form of compensation that they were receiving in Phillips and the appellant was receiving here. So there's different ways to look at it.
Well, again, there's no evidence of points in this record at all, as best I can tell. And Phillips does talk about pay, but it's relative to the day she committed the misconduct, not her effort to submit something that got her pay for something else. So I'm just trying to make sure I understand, you know, what your position is on, you know, when they list these six things that say she was serving with the armed forces, I see at least a couple that don't, there's just no facts to make the same analogy here. So we just cross them off and then look at the rest of them?
I believe there is some evidence in the record that he did receive points for some of his time, and I don't have that cite on me, but I can provide it to the court. I don't think it covers the entire span. To be honest, but I think there is some evidence in there. So I could provide that point. But when you look at Phillips and our Superior Court looked at, they talked about that she submitted voluntarily. And, I mean, I think the evidence is clear here. He is the one who put in for his the 120-day manpower days. He kept putting in those requests over and over again. And I think that is a strong indicator that he is voluntarily submitting. He also talked about in his unsworn about how he, at first, it was his directors that were kind of in charge of getting him days and his projects. But then in 2006, it changed, and that, quote, I took control and ownership of my IMA program. That's a defense exhibit, AM, page 3. So he even in that, he describes his displeasure with having to work with junior officers to try to have to get his manpower days and organize all this. So this all shows he's putting effort into these days. So I think the effort here is far more than the appellant in Phillips, who they just had to get in her car and drive to the base.
I guess my biggest problem is, in that sentence you just said, which days? You know, when the other cases where we allow the government to supplement the record, it kind of answered the mail. You know, this record seemed to complicate it, at least in some respect, and these charts that are created and where he was and what he did. And so that's just perplexing now what to do with that. And I'm interested in both sides' views on, can you order a debate to clean up a problem like this? Or if we think that the facts matter, can we find facts based on this? Or do we need to set the whole thing aside and let the government perhaps try again with the whole case?
With regard to the orders, I think what the government, when we submitted them, it was to show what dates he was under 2A jurisdiction. And so when looking at that, I think it's clear. You look at what he was doing and when. And when you look at the documents, they're self-authenticating under MRE 90711. There should be a presumption of legitimacy with those. With regard to the ones that have forgeries on them, then those would just fall under 2C. So if we were to take those out for some reason, then they would still fall under 2C. And I don't think there's any reason to doubt when the appellant signed the documents, and that's not the standard. The government has to meet this by a preponderance. So it's not beyond a reasonable doubt of when the appellant put pen to paper. Only he knows that. He dated it. So why should we not take that at its face value?
On the green 2A, those are 2A days on your chart?
Yes.
Okay. And is there any evidence that he actually physically showed up to work on those days?
I don't have date-for-date evidence. Because of the arrangement that appellant and his unit had where he wouldn't have to, but he didn't use consecutive dates. So basically throughout the fiscal year, when they needed him, they would call him up or he would call them and try to organize, get on projects. So there were dates that he received money when he wasn't doing anything. So some of those green dates when he's receiving pay, he wasn't doing anything. He's receiving housing and he wasn't doing anything.
And I asked the appellate's counsel this same question because the appellate certainly had a role in creating this morass of facts that we have to wade through now. But the government certainly did it as well. The government allowed him to basically come and go as he pleased. The government allowed him to track his own reserve duty without, for most of the charge time period, any accounting of what he was doing. Why should we not consider that and hold that against the government in terms of trying to balance the equities here?
Well, you know, when you look at the congressional intent behind Article 2C, Congress saw appellants such as this one trying to wriggle through loopholes to get out of jurisdiction for folks who have fraudulently enlisted and when there was recruiter misconduct alleged. And so they specifically, explicitly overruled cases like U.S. v. King and U.S. v. Russo, U.S. v. King being one where it was an appellant who was discharged and then came back and just acted like he still worked for the Army. And the court held that they couldn't get, they didn't have jurisdiction.
But so let's talk legislative history for a little bit. I get the point that the government's trying to make with introducing this Senate report. The Senate report also says this the new subsection is not intended to affect reservists not performing active service or civilians. Going back to the drafting of the UCMJ, when the Morgan draft and the Morgan Committee was doing its work and this was the UCMJ was being presented to Congress, there were real concerns voiced on behalf of the reserve community about Article 2 and specifically Article 2A, that the reservists did not, they wanted to have a bright line rule so that they knew when they were at home when they were and were not subject to UCMJ jurisdiction. Sounds like the government's proposing a test here, a fact by, you know, case by case test where reservists are never going to really know whether they're subject to the UCMJ or not.
Your Honor, our Superior Court in U.S. v. Phillips specifically stated that it would be a case by case basis. So it's not something that we brought. They could have gone bright line with Phillips. They could have gone with what the Air Force said, which was this was a 2A situation, and they chose not to. They specifically stated that it would be a case-by-case situation. And so that's why when you look at the appellant, you look at his history with this office, being there for 10 years, you look with all the steps he went through defrauding the government, and you look with why even in equity, looking at equity, why we have jurisdiction. This is Air Force money, Air Force people, Air Force systems. If he was in federal court, he'd be arguing that they didn't have jurisdiction over him because this was an Air Force crime. So I think when you look at the equities of it, it squarely belongs in a court martial.
Let's go back to Phillips. If in this 120 days and this arrangement that was made, and the crime is not this fraudulent vouchers, just for purpose of discussion here, and it's actually the marijuana use like in Phillips. Okay, do we have, if the marijuana use is done during the 120 days that the period is, okay, do we have jurisdiction on that day, or do we actually have jurisdiction on the date that the Phillips actually showed up for work under the loose arrangement that they had? Which one do we have jurisdiction over? Do you understand my question?
Yes, I think we would have jurisdiction if he was on active duty orders. He would have jurisdiction under 2A, and under 2C, we'd have jurisdiction on the date that he was actually performing the duties.
So even though he was only on orders for 120 days, you're actually expanding that to. I mean, there's 120 days he's authorized to work, and then there's 120 days that he actually works. And those days don't necessarily match because of a loose arrangement. In other words, I'm on orders for January, but I actually work those days in July. Okay? And I commit the crime
let's say I commit a crime in January and I commit the same crime again in July. You're saying we have jurisdiction under 2A for one and 2C for the other?
Yes.
So if a military member shows up and for work and works under a loose arrangement that particular day that that reservist is working, even though they're not technically on orders, is a 2C category?
Yes, if they
Why is it they're not getting paid that day? How do you get passed around the pay issue is what I'm concerned about.
In this case, the appellant was getting paid. He did receive housing and base pay for time that he wasn't working. Also, you'd look to see, in our case, the appellant traveled a lot. So he was receiving pay for travel and retirement points. So all those were pay that he was receiving during this time frame.
So on the purple days, was he receiving pay?
Yes, because it was part of his scheme to get the pay. So it was a step in the process to get pay.
So your position is not actually getting paid for the day, but actually something you're doing that allows you to get pay pursuant to your military duties?
Yes, for this case, the crimes that he was charged with were such that he was getting paid. It was a cumulative thing, and that's just real world. I mean, he couldn't do one step and get paid.
So if he was eating marijuana brownies while he forged his supervisor's signature, can we get him for both under your 2C theory or just the one?
Well, he's not eating the marijuana brownies in his status as a lieutenant colonel. He's signing the document in performance of his duties. So if we were in a 2C situation for that, I think it's different analysis. When you look at this particular appellant, you look at his history with the office, and that he was there for 10 years, he was the institutional knowledge of the office, and he oversaw and mentored younger officers on projects. You look at his performance reports for that time frame, and you see how much work was done during these 3 years where he was perpetuating this fraud on the Air Force. And those are at Prosecution Exhibit 74. So when you're talking about someone who's a team lead, described as a key team member, to say that he was not performing duties during this time frame, it's just erroneous. So then we move on to pay, which we've already discussed, and whether Morse is incompatible with Phillips, which I think it's clearly not when you look at the plain language and this real world. I mean, the appellant asks you to suspend reality and allow him to float using his lieutenant colonel status when he can perpetuate the crime, to be the vehicle to perpetuate the crime and not. So unless this court has further questions, I'd like to conclude.
I actually have one more. Okay, let's say a reservist out there, not on any orders, not on any not annual tour or IDT, not, okay, uses the system, though, to create a travel voucher, to create orders to go on a trip, then actually goes on that trip, comes back from that trip, and the trip is, to New Orleans or something, okay? So it has nothing to do with military duties, but he's saying he's going to a military installation down there, but he doesn't, okay? Instead, he goes to the Super Bowl game, or you pick your poison there. And then files a travel voucher. Okay. But he does it saying that he's, Lieutenant Colonel X in the system, using the military system. Is that something we would have jurisdiction over?
Yes, we would, because when he's at each step of the process, including his travel, he is doing this in his capacity as a lieutenant colonel. Now, he's not doing legitimate work when he's at the Super Bowl, but he's there because he is the appellant who used the system in his status to get there. He gets back, and he's using the system in his status to get paid for, the travel expenses. So we do have jurisdiction over that under 2C.
Can you say your plain reading of the statute? When he goes to the Super Bowl in civilian status, he's, quote-unquote, serving with the armed forces on that date?
Yes, because he did so He is able to do so because of his capacity as a reserve officer. He could not, literally could not be there if he was not a reservist attached to a unit and utilizing all that structure and that money to get there.
Well, he could be there. He just couldn't have got the government to pay for it.
Right? Yes. He wouldn't have been on. Yes. So, without further, I see my time is... This court must reject appellant's baseless request for relief and affirm the findings and sentence. Anything less would subvert the Congress's intent when they added Article 2C. This appellant should not be able to escape court-martial jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. What's clear, I think, from the government's argument is that they are seeking an unwarranted expansion of UCMJ jurisdiction over reservists. And there has never been an answer given to you that says, no, we didn't have jurisdiction then. And the bottom line is that that violates both the language of 2C, Phillips, and all the cases construing it. And I don't think that this court needs to follow that path. The government's theory apparently is that any fraud committed against the military is subject to UCMJ jurisdiction. My opponent said that if you're using your office essentially to commit a fraud, then you're performing military duty and jurisdiction would attach. But that's the whole point of the fraud. Obviously, nobody would be able to commit a fraud against the military if they didn't have access by virtue of their rank and office and access to the systems in order to do the act. So it doesn't make any sense. That's the basis of the crime in the first place. The idea, the distinction between a discrete act and a continuing offense, for one, there's been no authority, I think, provided about how we're going to distinguish what these are. And this, again, puts us in a situation where they're presenting a calendar and saying the entire time jurisdiction attaches. I would submit that based on the calendar that's been provided, if they can prove that appellant was on orders, that appellant was had committed any of the offenses at the time that he was on orders, which is only the orange and gray sections of the calendar, then perhaps jurisdiction attaches as to those offenses. But again, I don't think there's been adequate proof of when those offenses were committed. Appellant has been...
Would you agree, counsel, that if he's on block orders for 120 days, the jurisdiction can attach for everything he does during that time, regardless of whether he shows up to an office and sits down and types?
I think that's quite clear. Absolutely. What we don't have here, though, is evidence that that's what happened. And it's troubling to say that, I think we're all in agreement that if there are lawful orders, that during the period of the lawful order, an offense that's subject to UCMJ, that jurisdiction would attach, and that's fine. To then say that an offense that's committed outside of that period, jurisdiction would attach simply because they're getting paid for, that was a day that they were supposed to have worked earlier but didn't, that doesn't couch at all with Phillips or with the four-part test.
And your theory on why we don't know what just the green days on here, which I see 938s in the supplemental package that cover the green days.
Mm-hmm.
So you just said if those are legitimate orders, you would agree that 2A jurisdiction applied during that time, regardless of whether he came to work.
Well, but not on green days, Your Honor, because there's no allegation that offense was committed on those days.
But hypothetically, on the 31st of January 06 is a gray day in the midst of a whole bunch of green days. So that would be okay if these were valid orders. And your theory on why these are not valid orders is because they were pulled from arrows and...
There's been no evidence presented that anything other than the appellant entered this information into arrows and a document was generated as a result. But he's been charged with a wide array of fraud against the government, including making false documents, making false orders, including several of the orders that the government has presented. So what we need is, and what needed to happen at trial, was Colonel Purvis, potentially Major Eller, any of the supervising officers who would have had authority and should have said, yes, I'm going to authorize this request for manpower days. Do you recognize this document? Yes, I do. Is that your signature? Yes, it is. Okay, we're done. Didn't happen. And it can't happen now. And the government, again, has had multiple opportunities to do this. I also just want to say I'm troubled by a comment the government counsel made that he's performing duty. Doesn't matter if some of it, that he was performing lawful duty, and therefore we should find jurisdiction. Because the government's theory of trial was he committed larceny because even if he was performing lawful duty, the paperwork wasn't right. And that was the government's argument both to the military judge and to the members, stating, we don't care if he actually performed lawful duty. And they considered, yeah, maybe he did do some. We don't care. It doesn't matter. Every dollar that he received for doing his duty was theft. And now the government wants to say, well, he was performing actual duty. In fact, most of the time he was performing duty. So where does this larceny argument go? I think it undermines their theory of larceny, and that's very troubling. If the court were to adopt that theory, we'd then have to go back and look at and find out when was lawful duty performed, and if it was, should those counts of larceny attach? And I would say that I don't think they do, and unfortunately that record has not been made to you. And I just want to say, I understand that this is a troubling case for the court. I can understand why the court would want to affirm the judgment, given the allegations, given the findings. And it's not to say that that a finding of no jurisdiction in this case is going to allow people to commit frauds on the military rampantly. What it would do is set a clear line for reservists, which is important, about when jurisdiction attaches. And again, Puerto Rico has been at all times subject to federal criminal jurisdiction. And this was the choice that the government made. That was their election of forum, if you like, and they chose the wrong one. And that's this court's role, is to say the government has chosen the wrong forum because they were not able to prove jurisdiction. Go somewhere else. And I realize that that's not an easy decision to make, but it is the right one to make in this case.
Judge Hecker asked the government this question. I'll ask you, to the extent that there are ambiguities in the record and perhaps a lack of factual development, is a post-trial court order debate hearing an appropriate mechanism to clear up some of the ambiguities here?
Well, I anticipated the court might ask that question, and our position is I don't think that that's appropriate, partly because it's not obvious that that's actually going to clear up the issues. But beyond that, I'd be concerned about due process issues of having essentially a new trial over again. And I realize it would be limited to jurisdictional issues, but when you look at this case, jurisdiction is the whole case. In other words, you can't litigate the question of whether jurisdiction attaches without litigating effectively the entire case again. And at that point, it would seem that there would be double jeopardy concerns and due process concerns as well. So we would submit that the proper result would be to have a finding of no jurisdiction and that a hearing would not be necessary, but of course if the court orders one, so be it.
And would you agree the government could retry him, assuming they could get their jurisdictional act together? Do you think jeopardy is already attached and they're precluded from retrying him?
I think jeopardy has already attached. I think, I do think jeopardy is attached. Unless the court has other questions, I'll conclude. Thank you very much. I just wanted to thank you for accommodating my schedule over these last few months and appreciate the opportunity to be before you. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank counsel for being well prepared and very good arguments, and we'll obviously take those under consideration, and we will issue our opinion in due course.
All right.